Thanks very much, and it's of course a great pleasure for me to be here. This is, I don't know how many years I've been coming to these conferences, and this is an occasion where my luggage arrived, and so I'm wearing my own jacket, if you can remember. I thought I would set up my co-panelists on this occasion, which has been said is the 40th anniversary of the Levy Institute and the 90th anniversary of the publication of the General Theory. And it's coming up, not very long time, on the 100th anniversary of a greatly mysterious event, the Great Crash of 1929 and the depression that followed. And what I thought I would do is run through a very quick survey of what has been said over the years about the causes of the Great Depression and the Great Crash. And it's rather odd that we seem to know very little about it. Keynes, not that there hasn't been a lot of things said, Keynes in 1930 wrote, and of course he was not wrong, that it was a matter of the collapse of capital goods investment owing to a collapse of profit expectations, because prices were falling faster than costs. But as you can see, he described this process in rather abstract terms, and it's hard to get a handle on exactly what he was talking about. My father, writing in 1954, was not really writing about the Depression. It was a story of the crash. But he summed up with a few comments on the sources of the Depression itself: a bad income distribution, a bad corporate culture, too much leverage, a bad banking structure, a dubious foreign balance, and a poor state of economic intelligence, by which he meant that people hadn't read Keynes. And this did not, of course, rise to the level of a full-fledged analysis of the sources of the Depression. Milton Friedman and Anna Schwartz, writing a little bit later in the early 60s, presented their view, which was their view of everything, which was that the economy is naturally stable, and if something goes wrong, it's the government's fault. In this case, because the Federal Reserve presumed to have the power to prevent the money supply from collapsing, did not do so. And this, again, this is a nice example of the Friedman style of reasoning. Charles Kinderberger, reacting a little bit to Friedman and Schwartz, writing a little bit later, transferred the story to the international sphere and wrote about the weakness of the international monetary system. Peter Temin, attempting to challenge Friedman and Schwartz, came back to Keynes and described the sources of the Depression as an exogenous shock to the consumption function. A cause of the shock was not specified. Jude Winiski, writing a little bit later than that, of course, blamed the Smoot-Hawley tariff. And this was something which actually had a little bit of support from my father, who pointed out that the tariffs prevented the Peruvians from servicing their debts, which contributed to the banking problems. But that was not Winiski's argument. His argument was that if you violate the sanctity of free trade, the economy will go to hell. Larry Summers, writing in 1986, or quoted in 1986, I think it now, simply said that this was a matter of a failure of the exchange mechanism. That is to say, people had things to sell, people had things to buy, and something prevented them from doing this. It's quite interesting, in fact, that Summers' view of this matter is focused on exchange and not at all on production, but we can pass over that. Christina Romer, writing in 1988, really tracking something also that Ben Bernanke wrote in 1983, attributed the Depression to uncertainty. In other words, she linked the crash to the Depression. The crash supposedly created a cloud of uncertainty, which somehow caused the real economy to collapse. In fact, she writes, the stock market crash caused consumers and producers to become uncertain about the course of future income. Meanwhile, You may recall the rise of real business cycle theory, according to which really there is nothing much to explain. Cycles happen thanks to the ebb and flow of technologies. Total factor productivity fell, and the rest followed. Real business cycle theorists for a long time abstained from trying to apply their theory to the Great Depression. Sargent, in 1984, said, "I do not have a theory, nor do I know someone else's theory, that constitutes a satisfactory explanation of the Great Depression." Kehoe and Prescott, writing in 2002, were substantially bolder, and they offered the general equilibrium growth model as a foundation of the Great Depression. But they still have to answer the earlier comment of Robert Lucas in 1994, who asks a very sensible question: what technological or psychological events could have induced such behavior in a large, diversified economy? How could such events have gone unremarked at the time and remain invisible in hindsight? How indeed? Very sensible question. And I don't want to comment on the more recent work, which dates to this millennium, that blames the Depression on the New Deal, and specifically on the price-fixing efforts of the National Industrial Recovery Act. This work would very conveniently place responsibility for events that occurred in 1929, 1930, and 1931 on policies that were enacted in 1933, a true act of feat of rational foresight. In short, as the young people say, OMG, what a mess. We have a better view of the extinction of the dinosaurs, the fall of Rome, and the collapse of the Maya than our economists have given us, judging by the breadth and shallowness of the various hypotheses of the most defining event of the last century. The above list is not entirely wrong. It includes proximate causes, contributing factors, spurious correlations, and also empty and irrefutable assertions. What there isn't is a clear-cut precipitating event that might explain why this happened when it did. And in the absence of that, well, people come up with stories which do not appear to have a particular foundation. If there were such an event, then it would be necessary to ask if it could in fact have had the effects that were observed. And I will advert to Joseph Schumpeter and to my favorite footnote in the theory of economic development, which reads, "Add successively as many mail coaches as you please, you will never get a railway thereby." In other words, a technological change, he refers to, that cannot be reached from the previous condition by a set of infinitesimal steps. Jing Chen, and well, I should say, I think Chris Kennedy has the answer. I'm not going to give it to you now. I'll let him do that in a few minutes. But it's no detraction from the credit he's due for this work that to say that it's astonishing that no one has developed the particular thesis he's going to offer earlier. The clues are quite abundant. They're there in the industrial history of the 19th century. Walt Rostow, for example, in the writings of the institutional economists, notably Commons and Thurman Arnold, and in financial histories and in observable scars that remain on the North American landscape. There are even some clues in forensic work that Tom Ferguson and I published years ago. But in general, there's not a precipitating factor to be found in the economic literature, which is detached in a very clear way from the physical world and makes no connections, no relationship to the concessions to the second law of thermodynamics. What Jing Chen and I attempted to do in a book that was published early last year, Entropy Economics, The Living Basis of Value in Production, was to set a very simple foundation under a story about economic value particularly as it can be applied to resources and to commodities. And we offer a very simple expression. The entire mathematics is on this slide, a logarithm function with an argument that is related to the scarcity or abundance, it's a probability of a particular commodity, and the base of the logarithm, which is captures the degree of monopoly. And just to show you very quickly how this works, as a commodity becomes more abundant, its economic value tends to fall. And the logarithm function captures that quite effectively. Notice that this is a non-equilibrium theory evaluation. It does not reproduce from one period to the next because there's always an ongoing change in these probabilities as commodities or new technologies diffuse through the economy. And secondly, as the number of suppliers, the number of competitors increase, the degree of monopoly value of monopoly power also declines fairly rapidly. So that's the entire mathematics from the idea on the idea that I want to offer. And I will simply say that let's suppose that a low entropy resource is discovered at a particular moment in time. This means that there is a potential for great abundance and prosperity. But if you are in a business that does not use that resource and that will eventually be competing with the technologies that do use it, this will create a major increase in the uncertainty associated with your profitability, in fact, in your expectation of future profit. And this is very much in line with Minsky's stability is destabilizing. Industries which have committed large capital investments will suffer proportionately larger future losses, or for that matter, current losses. And as a result, they will see falling investment, falling valuations, and ultimately bankruptcies. This will not be necessarily associated with a very rapid improvement based on the new resource, because it takes time to build an infrastructure that can use the new resource. What was the US economy before the Depression and the New Deal? It was very substantially an agricultural economy. The agricultural economy was powered by horses, and one third of the land in that economy was forage for horses to power the production of food in the rest of that land. The largest industry was the railroads, and the railroads were powered by coal and steam. Now, oil was in use. There was a very, very large increase in the production of automobiles in the 1920s, but it was still a scarce resource. And the expansion of oil-based technologies was limited by the proven reserves. In 1928, those were estimated at 11 billion barrels. In 1938, it had gone up to 17.3. If you use, just plug this into our little equation, taking P at 0.4, relative scarcity, increase it by the growth of reserves, you've got a price drop of about half, which is almost what happened actually between 1929 and 1931. Now, admittedly, the reserves were not all proven by then, but the fact that they were much larger than expected in 1928 was known. In 1930, this young man, my father, immigrated from Canada via a ferry, you can see here, from Port Stanley to Cleveland, bought a Model T Ford with another student, and drove out across the United States on the first transcontinental highway, the Lincoln Highway. And he noted in his diary that from Lincoln, Nebraska to the California line, there were no paved roads. That was 1930. What was the New Deal? We've heard about the New Deal, Social Security, the Wagner Act, and other important programs. But it was also, to a very substantial extent, a federal program to build out the economy of oil. The New Deal paved 600,000 miles of roads. It built vast infrastructure, including the Triborough Bridge, the Lincoln Tunnel, the Bay Bridge. It built 1,000 airfields for aircraft that fly on oil. It helped to revitalize the railroads to some extent by replacing coal and steam with diesel electric. It built ships that ran on oil, including an aircraft carrier. And also it did a great deal in another major new energy source, which was hydropower and electrification. All of this was coordinated through the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, operating out of the Federal Reserve System by, of all things, a Texas oil man named Jesse Jones. Skipping ahead, so I won't completely step on my co-panelists, and also so as to say a few things about the present in the 5 minutes that remain. If we take the oil price now, or the oil price that was present at the end of February, and you take it as a relatively abundant resource with five major producing regions, and reduce the flow by 10%, which is what happened, and the regions by one, cutting out the south of the Gulf, you predict a price increase of 60%. And the first month of the war, the actual price increase was almost exactly that. So it just tells you, I mean, it's very rough, and I'm not going to make a big claim for this, but that we are not in an unreasonable position in offering you a very simple equation to explain valuation. And what would happen if you took off 20% and two regions, we would predict a price of 155, which is not far from the spot price now, but the futures price does not expect that to sustain. If you look at the cost of supply, you will find that at the pre-war price, the Permian Basin was already declining, not production, but the new wells were down by about a third from 2023. And if you look at the price between $80 and $100, that play becomes profitable again. So you can perhaps express that what is going on here can be seen as potentially a contest over who gets to extract oil at a price where the supply is restricted by a certain amount, but not too much. So this is a struggle, I would argue, in the oil economy. It's not about an energy transition as such, but about who gets to control a relatively abundant, but still, a relatively abundant commodity where the supply prices have to be, will allocate who in fact gets to do the production. And you can see that from this light, imposing a blockade on Iran in order, presumably, to reach some kind of arrangement where not all of the benefit flows to our supposed geopolitical adversary is not an entirely irrational move. All right, I will come to an end by simply translating all of this to the domain that we've been speaking about earlier, artificial intelligence. Like oil for coal, artificial intelligence is a very abundant, inexpensive, low entropy substitute for something. For what? Well, it's a substitute for real intelligence. That's the market that it is intervening in as the infrastructure gets laid out. What is real intelligence? I look out on this room and I tell you, real intelligence is a resource that requires a great deal of investment. It is a slow process in the maturation of human brains, requiring fixed investment in schools, colleges, universities, libraries, lots of time and care, discipline, teachers, and even professors are required to bring real intelligence to bear on the problems of the world. And when you bring in a cheap substitute, what's going to happen? All of this is being radically devalued, following exactly the same principles that we articulate in entropy economics. And unfortunately, as I'm speaking to an audience of college professors, students, as well as householders, not to mention parents and prospective parents who have to think about whether it's really worthwhile to have more children, I'm not telling you anything you don't already know, but I am saying that you have to think about how to structure a society where real intelligence is being priced out of the market, and it might be that the job guarantee Pavlina takes on a special relevance in light of the developments that are now underway. Thank you for your attention to this matter.